Welcome to Swiftly Spoken, a fan-made Taylor Swift podcast in which we break down her lyrics, deep dive into full album retrospectives, and theorise about what may be coming next. As always, we are your hosts, Cameron and Lisa, and in today's episode, we're going to be breaking down the sophomore slump and the profound effect it can have on an artist's career. Then we'll, of course, be relating it to Taylor's second album, Fearless. Much like our episode dedicated to the fourth album curse, we wanted to discuss another phenomenon many artists seem to suffer from, which is called the sophomore slump. So we're going to be defining what it is, talking about some prominent examples, speculating about why the second album seems to be a struggle for some artists, and obviously speaking about how Fearless fared within the framework of Taylor's entire discography.
So to start us off, we can talk about what exactly the sophomore slump is. So in general, the phrase seems to primarily be related to students, and it's defined as a decline in academic performance during a student's second year of university. So obviously when you're a sophomore, you're in your second year, suddenly maybe you're not trying as hard in comparison to the first year where you've given it your all, basically.
I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
That's definitely true.
Yeah, because when you're new to something, you know, you're trying your best, you're giving it your all.
It better be best, yeah.
Exactly. And then as time goes on, maybe you just kind of take your foot off the pedal a bit, you know, kind of go back into more laid back, and then suddenly it hits you that things can still go wrong, you know. It has also been applied and related more widely to general decreasing quality of performance in many different fields, and it's almost always in relation and in comparison to a very successful debut or first appearance or first year or first whatever. So for example, sophomore slump has also been related to athletes that maybe have poor results in competitions in comparison to their first like debut. And for us, most interestingly, what we're going to be chatting about today is in the case of music. So Billboard has a very interesting article all about sophomore albums, and they define the sophomore slump as a way to refer to an artist's second album failing to live up to the heights set by their first. So just as with the fourth album curse, which we did chat about a very long time ago now, there is a lot of debate about whether it's actually a thing or not, whether the sophomore slump actually exists. I think the sophomore slump in comparison to the fourth album curse makes sense. It does hold a bit more truth to it than the fourth album curse. I think the fourth album curse is very, very bit random and a bit depends on a lot of things lining up. But they do both have interesting explanations, which we'll be getting into. But I think the sophomore slump, it makes sense, even like the like you just said with the university, kind of, if you set yourself up, you build yourself up such a high standard, it's going to be very difficult.
You have to try and maintain. Mm. Exactly. And I think especially with the nature of an album, obviously your first, there's no expectation. I think often with artists, right, you know, they spend their entire lives, careers at that point making that first album. Mm-hmm. You know, often it's written across the span of 5 years. You know, like some of the songs, for example, on Taylor's debut was written when she was like 11, 12, 13, and then obviously released when she was 16. So there's like 3 years worth of content. Whereas the next one, you're then building off of what you've already established. You've established yourself and given yourself a sort of sound and image. And often the second album is made within, you know, not always the case, and we'll get into it, but often within like 2 years. And obviously made at a faster rate. So there's this kind of expectation you have to build off of something, and maybe you don't have the same amount of time, or, you know, and there's just way more pressure, I think, than the first. And I think with relating it to with the fourth album curse, I feel like the curse is almost like a theory rather than a genuine thing, if you get what I mean. I feel like with the sophomore thing is a genuine, oh, how on earth do I build off of this? Right. Because I think with the fourth album, like you said, it's more circumstantial and also slightly coincidental that lots of fourth albums haven't done that well, and often there's
and
other reasons
very
to explain
unlucky.
It.
Just like a very unlucky circumstance is like what we looked at. There was a lot of albums that it did make sense because some reasonings behind it, like, oh, a lot of people have already spent a lot of their time being established and now people are bored of that same sound. Mm. A lot of time has passed in the music industry and, you know, different sounds have come about and new artists, and in comparison, they may pale, the fourth album may pale in comparison to a first album by someone else. So I guess that did have its own explanation, but a lot of the ones that we did discuss was just like unlucky circumstances which have been led to, like, even the name itself, curse, is very like magical or mystical, and sophomore slump is something more grounded in reality, it would seem. Either way, we're going to be getting into some of the reasonings behind why this happens. And just as you mentioned just there, Cameron, which makes a lot of sense for music lovers and for people who follow a lot of artists and like to, you know, kind of like track how the turnaround of albums come about. Another YouTuber called ARTV, very interesting video they made on the fourth album curse as well, which we do recommend. But they mentioned that they quoted something, which is your whole life to make your first album, only a year to make your second one. Meaning that for many, many artists, the first album, like you said, they spend years perfecting it, polishing it, really, really looking into each and every single song and saying, right, this makes the cut, this doesn't. And then suddenly, you know, the turnaround of the music industry is quite quick. So you're faced with, right, now you only have like a portion of that time to make a follow-up.
Yeah. And again, and more of an expectation, you know, whereas before you're picking from probably quite a catalogue of music and picking the best, now you're like, oh my god, I've got to make 13 new songs. You know, there's more of a kind of expectation, and it's different for, you know, different artists, but I feel like that is more of a shared experience, I think, with artists, is that the first year you spend your entire life at that point making, and then the next one is like, okay, how do I build off of that?
So that leads to many artists sometimes rushing things, and that is why the drop of quality may come about. Another reason, which you also kind of touched upon, is the hype that has been built after an extremely successful debut album. So if you have a debut album that is like Grammy award winning, how do you follow up to that? You know, it's just so much pressure. I can't even imagine.
Oh yeah, exactly. And because obviously you've been praised, you know, the highest praise in the music business. And, you know, especially if you've won things like Album of the Year or Record of the Year, think, you know, like the big ones, it's like, how on earth do you recreate that?
Yeah, because the follow-up to that is not just is expected to be just as good, you're expected to be better. So how do you even do that? Like, anything in comparison to that is going to look like a failure, right? Even though it isn't, which is something that we'll get into. Some of these albums, like we said with the curse video, some of these albums may be classified this way, but you've got to look at it in a much wider context and framework and think, well, it's not that it's a bad album, it's just that within the context of the situation, it looks bad, right? Another reason is that after such an amazing debut, some artists decide to kind of just stick with what they've made for the first album and try and recreate it. But sometimes it's like lightning in a bottle, like you can't recreate something because sometimes things just work in that moment in time, in that specific moment, right place, right time, right? So It's a bit sad, but it sometimes gets a bit boring and you're just like kind of extending, you're trying to build and extend off of what you already made, and the magic's not there anymore. I think that's one of the saddest reasons that this, like the sophomore slump, can come about, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The fourth reason, funnily enough, is that sometimes the second album suffers from like a prolonged pause between projects. So like the first reason we said it's too rushed, and this fourth reason is that there's too much time between one project and the next, which we're going to see some examples of. But again, people are waiting and waiting and waiting, and then suddenly people become bored of waiting.
Exactly. Yeah, people become bored, and there's new artists on the scene and the music industry's totally changed. There's a new sound, or, you know, for some artists, you know, there might have been a shift from like physical, a push for physical into then digital, into streaming, you know, like the music industry does move quite quickly. And yeah, if, you know, if you've waited 4 years, there's 4 years worth of new albums, new artists, and previously well-established albums and artists releasing things, you know, and so you're just having to then compete with so much more. And, you know, people have moved on since you released 4 or 5 years ago. And sometimes that can be quite hard to build back off of as well.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree. And then finally, we have basically a combination of these reasons coming together at a very unfortunate time in an artist's career. So we're going to look at some examples now, and we're going to see that some artists just have really bad timing with things, and that kind of heightens the other reasonings and the sophomore slump even more. So it just combines together, and sadly, sometimes it just looks kind of bad. It just is not a good time for them. So we'll get into that. But these are the main reasons of why the sophomore slump is kind of renowned, why it comes about, really, which makes sense to me. I think they are rational explanations to why this happens, especially for me, that second reason, the hype being really, really built from a debut album that has just smashed it. It's a lot to live up to. It really is.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think even Taylor herself has kind of mentioned that, you know, even just with like fourth, fifth, sixth album, you're constantly competing with your back catalogue. And obviously, it's so hard to build off of that. And especially if it's been incredibly successful. So yeah, I can imagine that that's difficult to build off of as well. Okay, so now we're going to get into some examples. And as always, we're going to be discussing albums that may be considered to have suffered from the sophomore slump. By mentioning these albums, it does not mean that they are automatically bad. This is just not the case at all. And obviously this section will be getting into our opinions and often some general opinions that are held by the internet. As ever though, these are our opinions and these will differ from other opinions, so just take them as they are. But also we'll just mention as well that we'll be discussing more recent examples, mainly within the pop genre, because these are albums that obviously we're familiar with and often are fans of. But this kind of theory of the sophomore slump has existed throughout time and a variety of different genres. And if you are interested in looking at the sophomore slump across different genres and different musical time periods, then, as we mentioned previously, the ARTV video, we would definitely recommend you go and watch, as it discusses all sorts of different kind of albums and artists, including some of the likes of U2 and Rolling Stones. But yeah, we're now going to get into some of the examples and discuss whether they did or didn't suffer from the sophomore slump. So firstly, we're going to be mentioning Haim. So basically, they are mentioned in the sophomore slump mainly due to the fact that their initial album Days Are Gone was met with massive critical and commercial success, big singles, and just generally very successful. But from the time in between the release of Days Are Gone and Something to Tell You, there was a lot of time passed between their beloved debut album, which was released in 2013, and then Something to Tell You, released in 2017. And therefore, because of that, and as we kind of mentioned with some of the theories, basically, unfortunately, it did suffer, I believe, from an element of the sophomore slump. Want You Back, the lead single, was actually really successful and probably one of their biggest singles at that time. But because of touring for multiple years and 2 years, which I generally believe was successful in their career for showing them as like a really solid live band and basically building up love for Days Are Gone, I think that that touring made Days Are Gone such a beloved album and had so much success commercially and critically. They basically, people almost just got so associated with that, but by the time they rolled out Something to Tell You, it had been so long since their initial that unfortunately it charted one position lower on the Billboard 200 and the UK album charts. However, what is interesting to mention, and something that we can mention with some of the artists that have more than two albums, is that actually their third album, Women in Music, was not the case of slumping at all. It built massively off of Something to Tell You and was incredibly successful and met with extreme critical and commercial success. So it's interesting, and I think that Haim is a really interesting example of having too much time in between releases. How do you kind of feel about it all?
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you. 2013 to 2017, like you were saying before, the musical world completely changed in those years.
Yeah.
Completely.
Think about it. Taylor was in the Red era, and then by the time 2017 rolled around, she was in Rep. Yeah.
The changes, not just in everything, like how music, the most popular music of that moment, how it sounded, the way that it was distributed and consumed. Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Completely different. So obviously it was a big learning curve, I'm sure, for them. And I guess, like you said, you are very, very familiar with Haim. You know a lot about all the ins and outs of them as a group and their music. So I completely agree with you with everything. But like you said, it's the tour that they did after Days Are Gone and the build up of that album and how it grew slowly over time was very, very critical to cement them as a band and as a part of the music industry at all. So they needed to do that. But again, it's one of those cases where it's kind of extended just for a little too long. So when the next
Sometimes
thing came
it can
around,
be, almost be a detriment.
Yeah, yeah. When the next thing came around, you're so very associated with that first thing that it's like, well, this second thing, I'm not sure what to feel about it. Change, something different. Not sure. So I think maybe people found it. I mean, one position lower isn't too bad. It's not too bad at all. But it's just funny to see how it kind of, there was a little bit of a slump downward But then, like you said, it went back up again with Women in Music Part 3, and people love Haim now. So as you can see, just because you have an album that may be classified by some as a sophomore slump, it doesn't mean that it's the end of your career. It doesn't mean that it's a bad album per se. It just means that in comparison to the first one, it looks a bit different. It looks like something as there is maybe a slight degrading quality. And in the case of Haim, I don't think so. I think it was more to do with, like we've said, completely agree with you, in the case of Haim, it is just that long amount of time between one and the other and how it kind of could have affected them. But in the end, they turn it back around, so that's great to see. So next up, we're going to be talking about Billie Eilish and Happier Than Ever. So in 2019, as we all know, she released When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, which was just such a massive success. And I think this was mainly built up by her many previous releases. She had EPs, which were, you know, really, really incredible. She'd done really well previously with like Ocean Eyes. So I think that she had a lot of time. In fact, she worked on the album. It was written between 2016 and 2019. So it's quite a long time to be able to perfect the sound, see what people liked from the EPs, see what you liked from the EPs. Obviously, she works with her brother Phineas, so they could work together all around the clock, really, and really, really just polish it, basically, until she came up with, and they came out with, this amazing, massive success of an album. It really was a smash. What can we say? It was very, very heavily awarded Grammy Album of the Year, Best Pop Vocal Album. It also won her a few other Grammys. Smash singles, Bad Guy, just to name like one. Come on, she was everywhere, right? So I really do think that this is one of the big examples of having a debut that is so massive, and a debut album that is just everywhere.
She like earned like 5 Grammy, you know, like that's mental. Like,
it's crazy. Yeah,
to do that on your debut album, like earning 5 Grammys and winning like Album of the Year, like that's just huge. Like yeah, like you can't, like, and especially that young as well, to achieve that level of success,
extremely,
and that level
young
of critical acclaim, is just like, that would just be like, oh my god, because it's like you haven't really done enough to really know what you have done that's good or bad. It's just everything you're doing is good.
Yeah.
And you just, and it must just feel like, okay, so what is it that they really like about me? Because everything so far they're liking, you know, it's just like, if I did this, is that, you know,
right.
I couldn't imagine
that's
how, yeah, the effect that must have had on the creation.
Yeah. And you're also very heavily scrutinized at that point. So like we said before, like the pressure that is put upon you for the follow-up of what is coming next is just, I don't know, insurmountable. I can't even imagine how you must feel after hitting such a home run to be like, okay, now I sit down. And even before the era is finished, there's people saying, well, whatever comes next, we'll see if it lives up to this. Can she continue? Is she just a one-hit wonder? You know what I mean? So, wow, I can't even imagine. But so that leads us to 2021, which is a relatively quick turnaround. Honestly, the album Happier Than Ever was made in just over a year, so the difference between like 3 whole years and just over 1 year is quite big. You know, it's double the time you get to work on it and really polish it and perfect it, and this is like more of a quick turnaround. Also, her sophomore album is a clear example of wanting to completely depart away from her already established image, both in a change of look, so she like, you know, dyed her hair, she was now blonde, and in sound, which the album Happier Than Ever is more influenced by like jazz. It's not so R&B based, I want to say, as When We All Fall Asleep.
Yeah, slightly like trap.
Exactly, it departs away from that. So moreover, this album then was affected by a bit of bad luck, because it was during the pandemic, so that paused its rollout. There was a year between the lead single and the release of the album. That is a long time. It's a long time. And that is also a
detriment. Also the singles in comparison to When We Fall Asleep, like My Future, Therefore I Am, and Your Power, were like debuted at number 6, 2, and 10.
Right.
You know, they weren't like number ones or anything like that.
Right.
And I think that also, and yeah, like you said, to have a year's gap as well, I think, in between when a single and album's released, it's like the sound's changed. And I think that the sound on Happier Than Ever maybe wasn't as like sonically cohesive, not to sound like Red Taylor, 1989 Taylor, and Red Taylor, as maybe, you know, When We All Fall Asleep, because, you know, when you release something in a year later, the amount of music you must be making and changing up, it must be quite hard to kind of stick to a kind of unanimous like sound. And I think ironically, even the biggest song of that album now, which is Happier Than Ever, that debuted like number 11, like that peaked at number 11, sorry. Like, so it wasn't even a top 10. And I'd say that that is the arguably the standout.
That's interesting.
And the best track.
Yeah. So as we always say, you know, debut positions on the Billboard or, you know, charts don't mean everything. This is just an interesting way of gauging how the single was received. It is one way, but obviously that doesn't mean that I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are listening who love the album. We don't mean anything bad by it. It's just interesting to see the comparison, definitely.
Yeah, I love Happier Than Ever. Right. I've got that album on CD and vinyl, and I do love When We All Fall Asleep. But for me, I think Happier Than Ever is, I love it.
I think it's a
really impressive album.
I prefer When We All Fall Asleep, personally.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, but that's just me.
I think When We All Fall Asleep has better songs.
Right.
Like the song I Love You, that song is gorgeous. Like,
I know, a lot of people incredible. Love that song, yeah.
But I think as an album, I think that Happier Than Ever, just the way that I think the production's really clear. I think it's one of those albums that you have to take it as a body of work, like as an album.
Right.
Like, I think that the way the songs flow into each other is really clever, the production's really clever, and some of the songwriting's really, like, quite witty as well. So I think, yeah, it's one of those that was almost slightly, I don't know, maybe people were seeing Billie as like a pop, you know, just like a pop artist, bad guy was what they knew her for. And then to come out with something that was maybe a bit more like conceptual and an album and, you know, had elements of jazz and things like that was maybe a bit like, oh, you know,
yeah, maybe this isn't what we expected. Yeah, this is exactly. It. This is exactly what happened.
Of this, like, you know, big T-shirt wearing bad guy singer. No, you know, that's how she was kind of viewed before.
That's actually very brave to have such a built up album and then say, right, I'm not going to do anything of what that was. I am something different. This is my variety.
Yeah, and I think, dyeing the hair, as you mentioned as well, also to, you know, completely move away from your previous as well, to kind of cut that off. I think Billie was a clear idea of not trying to build off of what you had before, but totally changing up.
Exactly.
And I think that was met with, you know, a variety of different success. I think fan-wise, I think it was met with really good fan response.
Okay.
And I think critically it was a mixed bag, and obviously chart-wise, again, a bit of a mixed bag, but I think that her tour has been really successful. You know, she, like, headlined Glastonbury. So I think that she's still, I don't think it's affected her career at all. I think if anything, it's maybe, you know, shown different sides to her as a musically and all sorts of performance wise. And I think that's the thing.
It's purposes. Yeah,
exactly. And I think even with things, and this is obviously a third album, but things like Solar Power, for example, this obviously got nothing to do with Sophomore Slump, but we'll get into Lord's sophomore album. Obviously that was met with awful critical and fan response, but had a really successful tour, and she's been touring for, you know, so sometimes these things can work out in positives in other ways, if you get what I mean. It's a very rambly way, but I think that Happier Than Ever is a prime example of the sophomore slump, definitely, in different ways.
Yeah, it's seldom like the be-all and end-all of someone's career, but I mean, it was a good album. We know that. You enjoy it. I'm sure a lot of people enjoy it quite a lot, and it has had a lot of success. However, it just pales slightly in comparison to her first album, which is just, it's the prime example of the slump, plus the added bad luck of the pandemic, plus just the massive, massive thing that her first album was, and the comparison between them. You can't help but compare, and it's sad. For example, with the Grammy things, again, Grammys aren't everything. Doesn't mean any, we've mentioned this before, Grammys don't mean everything, but it just is another interesting thing to see. Yeah, so she had 7 Grammy nominations for Happier Than Ever and lost every single one. So in a way, it does look like a bit of a slump after the smash of all of the Grammys in the When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go era. Next up, we have Nicki Minaj, which is basically, we're going to talk about this one because I think that is a good example of what looks like a continuation of a first album, but is actually more of a bait and switch than what you would imagine. So her debut album is Pink Friday, which is an iconic debut. I think everyone has seen the cover of that album. I think everyone knows at least a few songs off that album. It was released in 2010, and it has songs such as Moment for Life, Super Bass, come on. So just
some classics.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows those songs, like Super Bass. It is the Nicki Minaj song. And honestly, for a debut album, it had a lot of amazing collaborations on there as well. It did debut at number 2 on the Billboard 200. And it also held the record for the most weeks in the top 10 of the Billboard 200 chart by a female rap album. And it spent, 14 consecutive weeks in the top 10. So it was very, very received really, really well. It was an extremely popular debut. I mean, like, she just came out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Like, she was nowhere and then she was everywhere.
Yeah, it was weird at that time. Yeah, like, you never really heard of her before and suddenly every song was, like, massive and she was just everywhere. She had, like, Perfume and this and that. And it was just, I remember that period of, like, Nicki Minaj, because that was when she was, like, wore, like, really colourful, outlandish, like, pink clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, really successful debut.
Yeah, and very much internationally. So that leads to the interesting rollout of her second album, which is called Pink Friday, Roman Reloaded. So, firstly, we're already seeing that we're kind of getting built off of the first album, Pink Friday, Roman Reloaded. And you're like, ooh, this is a bit awkward, because whenever you pull so much on a first album to make a second album, you know that something may go wrong. Because a couple of years have passed now, it was in 2012, and it's like, we don't want to listen to the same album again. But we've already listened to it once, and a deluxe, you know?
Exactly, and that's what I mean. I think that by calling it that, it almost gives it the impression that it's just the deluxe version of the original album.
A little bit, yeah.
Like, as, you know, someone that maybe isn't a hardcore fan that would know, it's like Fearless Platinum Edition. You know, you would just think, oh, Pink Friday, Roman Reloaded. Like, Reloaded, that just sounds like, like the expanded edition. You know, like with, say, Teenage Dream, for example, again, which we'll get into, that obviously had, like, The Complete Confection, like, 2 years later, which was, like, a deluxe version. So I think that that's almost slightly confusing to use the same name and the word Reloaded. That would definitely confuse audiences, I think.
Yeah, I think the marketing of that was a bit, as people who aren't, like, really deep in the fandom or aren't as knowledgeable about, you know, the explanation of it at that point in time, just to some an outside observer, it seems like that. It does seem like it's going to be more like a deluxe kind of thing when it's a completely different album. So it also was pushed back. It was initially going to be released in February of 2012, and then it had to be pushed back to April of that same year. So that also kind of made people think, is it rushed? She decided to change quite a few things, add some things. She wasn't happy with it. So kind of does make you question, was there some people pushing for it behind the scenes? I'm not really sure. Either way, it did debut at number 1 on the Billboard 200, and it does have the amazing single Starships, which a lot of people know as well. Like, it's just as iconic.
Again, a classic.
A classic Nicki song. But it did receive mixed reviews from critics at the time of release. I think the problem here is that the first album always followed Nicki around, even to this day. But the second album isn't a continuation of the first. It's more of a conceptual album. Obviously, she is developing this character in the album, Roman. And, you know, there's much more going on. There's a lot going on in that album, to be honest with you. And the stories that it's telling are more conceptual, are more thematical. And I don't know. I don't know if people somehow expected it to be more of the same. And because of that expectation, we're kind of disappointed, which is completely the opposite to what happened with Billie Eilish, for example, that did market it as something very different. This is marketed as something that to outsiders maybe looked the same, but then was also very different.
Yeah, and I think that's what's interesting is that this is two examples of changing it up totally and maybe not having the response because it's different from what you had established yourself as. And then with Nicki, establishing yourself off of what you had in terms of calling it a similar name, but then the album itself is very different, but marketing wise seems the same, seems to also be a bit of a problem. It's almost like a bit of a poison chalice.
It is. It's like, what can you do then? But either way, it is interesting how, it wasn't a continuation at all, and she never marketed it really to, like, core fans or people who were watching interviews at that point and stuff like that as a continuation, because funnily enough, her upcoming fifth album, which is going to be released this autumn, is called Pink Friday 2, and that is supposed to be the continuation of Pink Friday, Which is very, very interesting.
Which is so confusing. Like, how can you have three albums basically called Pink Friday?
Also,
like,
in 2020, I think there was a 10-year anniversary version of Pink Friday. And then there's the deluxe version of Pink Friday. So there's a lot going on with Pink Fridays. And then obviously you have the pink print.
Yes, I think maybe we need to pick a different day of the week and a different colour.
Yeah. But it seemed like it was an attempt to use that name to place more of a hype on this second album. But like we just said, it is dangerous to create hype and then do something very different. Next up, we have a UK artist we thought we'd talk about, which is Jessie J. So I think this is just another example of how a debut can be so extremely, can spawn so many hit singles, and then the next one is just like silence. Which is a shame, but so Jessie J, her debut album was released in 2011, and it's called Who You Are, and it spawned so many hit singles, especially in the UK, but even internationally. Like, she was everywhere. She was international. Yeah. Like, she broke through to the European market. I know that. Like, she was on radios over here. So we have songs like Do It Like a Dude, Price Tag, Nobody's Perfect, Who's Laughing Now, Who You Are. That is the 5-single run Dominate. From this album.
Yeah.
That's, like, incredible. Like, I'm sure that... I'm not sure if... all of our listeners, because we're not sure like the age range of our listeners, but if you are around our age, then you know all of these songs, like especially if you're from the UK, but also internationally, like I said. However, very sadly, her second album, Alive, which was released a couple of years later, 2013, the singles, it's just in general as an album, not that recognizable. Even for me, like I had a little look at like the covers of these albums, because sometimes, you know, some covers are just like in your head. You know what I mean? Like you see it and you're like, oh my God, yes. Especially for people who lived through kind of like the beginning of like the iPod era, where we all had like, you know, iPod Touch, where you like had that on the screen. You had iTunes, things like that. Like you, this is what you saw, right? So Jessie J, Who You Are is just a very iconic cover. And Alive, I didn't recognize it. I've forgotten about this. I don't know. We have Wild, It's My Party, Thunder.
Yeah, Thunder, I remember, but I couldn't tell you how it goes. And Wild again, I feel like I couldn't really tell you much about. And It's My Party, I feel like now you've said them, they ring a bell, but not anywhere near
like
the
you
way
couldn't
of her
sing
debut.
It.
And I think, I think the problem with her was that she obviously totally changed up her image. Like, she like shaved her head, dyed it blonde. And also, I think she became a bit of a meme. She became a bit of a joke. Like, when you think of Jessie J now, you think of all those videos of her, like, singing on an aeroplane or, like, doing the no, you know, like, all of that. Like, I think that she unfortunately became slightly overexposed, but in, like, a negative way, and then maybe wasn't seen as, like, a legitimate artist and wasn't taken seriously.
That's
and
sad.
I think that was a detriment maybe to the second release, and maybe the second release was slightly rushed to build off of the success, and therefore they just didn't kind of hit in the same way. And I don't really know, as I'm not a Jessie J fan myself, and it's more that in the UK you just know it. It's a bit like Little Mix. You don't have to be a Little Mix fan to know every song that
you know
band has ever released.
Exactly.
If you live in the UK, you know every single Little Mix song ever, inside out. You can sing it backwards. And Jessie J was slightly similar with her debut. And I just think that maybe that was why she maybe wasn't taken serious with the second. She did obviously have a massive single on her third album with Bang Bang. So she was still able to kind of have...
Especially
in the States. After that, though,
Was able to become more of a, you know, kind of depart from
like
where she had been and go to the States and that. Yeah, that's... And she's extremely talented, so it's very sad to see how that happened. Like you said, I kind of do see what you mean. Like, again, as outsiders looking in, some aspects of the career, which is it's interesting to see, of course, people who are deep in the fandom because they know all of the outs and ins and everything of these albums. But it's also interesting to see perspectives of people who aren't maybe so part, you know, they're not part of those fandoms, but do know of them, because in the end we are the general public, and we always talk about the GP and how important they are for certain albums, you know, flopping or not. So yeah, it is a shame, because she's extremely talented and an incredible lyricist who has been involved in writing many incredible songs. But I agree, I think maybe her image suffered because of that, like you said.
Yeah, it's weird how and I think this is something that obviously we could potentially get into, but mention very quickly because it's quite a big debate, is changing up the image can have a real, real impact. Mm. And weirdly, the shaving of the head is a very strange thing that seems to be quite a negative thing in pop culture. Obviously, the biggest example of it is Britney Spears, obviously, and was deemed as like a lack of mental stability and was mocked quite heavily. Obviously, the next big example would be like Miley Cyrus, like bleaching and cutting her hair. And again, she was kind of seen as like crazy and, you know, overly sexualized and all of that. And then obviously then the next one was Katy Perry when she did it. I think all of the times people are doing it is because they're trying to depart from what people have known them as. Britney obviously just was just in such an awful state that she just wanted to shave it and just be like, I'm just done with that. Miley obviously was to shed Hannah Montana, and Katie was to shed the idea. She just hated the idea of being Katy Perry, you know, and totally changing up the image of the black hair, bangs, whatever, to go with this blonde. And I think that that's also maybe the same with Jessie J, is that weirdly the general public sometimes take that as, oh, they've lost the plot. So
that's,
I'm not sure if that was maybe a factor as well.
Yeah, that's incredibly... It's a very interesting thing, which I'm sure has been studied by professionals who know much more than us. But no, it's very interesting. Mm. That is true, how sometimes maybe the portrayal and the image, sometimes people maybe, unfortunately, kind of like scared
have
off.
Negative conversations.
Yeah, have already preconceived notions in their head, like, oh, I don't want to be associating with that, which is a very... No, that's sad. Yeah.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. So unfortunately, that is what happened. And I would like to see more from Jessie J. I'm not completely sure of what she's up to nowadays. Her last album was a 2018 Christmas one.
Yeah, I believe that she did release a string of EPs. And I believe she's released a couple of singles here and there, but none with any big success. I think she's just one of those artists, maybe slightly like Carly Rae Jepsen, that has a really strong fan base and they really like her music, and she's just comfortable kind of being in that lane,
which is brilliant as well. Success. It's another you need artists of all types, and sometimes, you know, it's better to be kind of in that sphere than under the limelight and 100% of
exactly
the time.
And some artists prefer that. I know that Lana Del Rey much prefers just releasing music, and you know, she has a very solid, strong, massive fan base, incredible like support and success, and you know, she strays away, I think, from the mainstream ideas of success in terms of, you know, these like number one singles and all of this.
Which,
and no
like
one
we
really
said, doesn't
pulls
define
her
anything.
In.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And weirdly, she evades all of these conversations because I think she evades the tradition of like how to release albums and all of this. She's someone that releases albums quite regularly and songs quite regularly. Yeah. And her songs are longer and more poetic in a sense, so you know, you can still be incredibly successful and be incredibly critically and sometimes commercially successful and maybe not fit to the standard idea of you have to have a number one song and number one album to be successful, you know. It's all
no
in
that's
respect,
it yeah
isn't it? I think whatever works. So next we're going to mention Harry Styles and obviously his very, very, very famous sophomore album Fine Line. And I think what's interesting is the Harry's kind of career at this point, obviously he'd been an incredibly successful boy band, One Direction, huge success. And his debut was met with massive success. Obviously he had Sign of the Times, that went number four on the Billboard charts. Then the album itself topped the Billboard 200 and had the highest first sales week for a British male solo artist. And the subsequent singles, maybe not as strong as Sign of the Times, but were massive fan favourites, Kiwi, Carolina, things like that. But I think then what kind of happened with Fine Line, again, I think was a slightly maybe stunted start, because I think off of the strength off of the lead single, like Lights Up, which peaked at like number 17, that doesn't really bode for like a good start to an album. I think the problem with Lights Up was that it maybe wasn't the best choice for a lead single, I don't think. How do you think about that?
Yeah, it is an interesting one, isn't it? Because then Fine Line has a lot of other songs. Would have suited it better as an opener, though I do understand like the imagery and the reasons why. But for me, looking back, I don't know, but even Sign of the Times,
I think everyone forgets that that's the lead.
Yeah, even Sign of the Times is a bit of a strange choice. Harry is never really, and that is why it's different for Harry, and that's why we place him in here as well, because it's a different kind of debut and sophomore album. When you're already a previously established artist, it's an extremely different way, but you do have to still, you know, make a name for yourself and depart away from who you were previously with a boy band.
You can use that fan base to be like, okay, you guys know me, but I have to now establish myself as mine, and you have to be a fan of me as Harry Styles, not as Harry Styles from One Direction.
Exactly.
And I think that it's interesting because obviously I think with the effort of Harry's fans are incredibly dedicated.
Oh yeah.
And I think with the kind of goodwill and dedication and resilience from his fans, Fine Line did debut at number one on the Billboard 200. Massive kind of debut provoked by like huge later singles of like Adore You, Watermelon Sugar, which obviously went number one. He earned his first Grammy Award for. So I think that actually, weirdly, Fine Line, I think especially over lockdown, just grew. Like, that album is really, really impressive. It is a really, really solid album. And I think was then met with incredible critical and then later commercial success. Like, it was one of the only three albums released in 2019 to have sold 1 million copies in pure album sales in the US. Critics also was on the top of their year-end lists. And even decade-end and sometimes all-time rankings for albums. And I believe that it's often described as his Rumours, you know, like Fleetwood Mac, his, like, in comparison to that that's your album, you know, like, that is your album that you will be remembered for.
I'm not sure about that myself.
Yeah, but... me too.
But
I have seen some, people say that. So obviously that's all opinion-based. But,
of course.
But yeah, so Fine Line is a real interesting one because technically not a slump at all in comparison. Like, literally it's had number one.
But Danger.
Singles, number one album, but then seemed, like a slightly stunted start, but then went on to be incredibly successful, and I would not describe it as a slump at all. And obviously then his later album Harry's House has built off of that and has, you know, got even more Grammys and been even more successful, and As It Was massive, and I think As It Was a perfect, I think they learned from their mistake, I think, and As It Was was perfect
for what a lead single has to be, right? Really, really well done. No, I think that's going to be very interesting to see more of Harry's career, especially as we are nearing whenever he... I know he's on a break at the moment, but whenever he does come to that fourth album, and the fourth album curse looms in the distance.
Yes.
Again, though, it is interesting to see, because he is a different kind of... He's kind of like an exception because you are already an established artist, so it's different. It's different.
Exactly.
But it's interesting because of that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting with Harry as well is that he's very traditional in terms of album singles. You know, he doesn't have any droplets at all.
No, here's the album. Songs
off of an album.
Here are the singles.
Yeah, it's like, here's the lead single.
Yeah.
Here's like a promo. Here's the album. Then here's a couple of singles, music videos. I tour.
But it works.
You know, that. And he might break away from that. You know, no features, nothing at all. He is very much establishing himself as a single entity rather than part of multiple. So I think Harry's career is something that's really interesting and will definitely be, like you said, interesting to see if the fourth album curse does have an effect on whatever Harry puts out next, and building off of what he has established, which is just massive. You know, he's probably one of the biggest male pop stars going right now.
So now that we've spoken about all of these different examples for many different reasons about albums that may or may not have suffered through the sophomore slump and why, we also want to talk about Olivia Rodrigo, because just as with our fourth album curse episode, we did mention Adele's 30, which at that time was still upcoming, and Olivia Rodrigo's album at the point of us recording this podcast is out this week. However, when this episode is out, you will have the album, you'll be able to listen to it in its entirety. So if you have listened, leave us a comment telling us, do you think it suffers from the sophomore slump? How do you feel? Does it compare to any of the previous examples we've spoken about? We wanted to give our two cents as to what we have seen of the Guts era up to this point. Obviously, first we have to speak about Sour and just how massive it was, because it was everywhere. And Olivia Rodrigo's case reminds me a lot of Billie Eilish, right? Because
100%.
You couldn't escape her, right? She's everywhere, Grammys, everything.
Number one songs, debuting on like the Billboard number one with your debut single. Like, that's mental, you know? Like, it takes people their entire career and sometimes never in their career to get a Billboard number one. And to get, you know, your debut single and then another single on your debut album and your debut album to go number one as well. And all of the singles be massive and really well known. Mm-hmm. Incredible critical response, general public response, huge album, like iconic cover, you know, like a proper, everything about that was very iconic. The symbolism with like all the purple and everything was a really, I think, a really well rounded era. Like,
yeah, I don't know,
they did a really good job
all of the promo and everything, but it was just done really well, I have to say. Like, marketed extremely well.
You couldn't avoid,
obviously,
you couldn't avoid her.
No, you couldn't. And obviously that a lot of talent behind it, you can't not say that, because there is a talent. A lot, I don't know, whoever was choosing the image of it all, no, it was just so well done. It's really, really a polished album, I have to say. Which is interesting as we lead into the follow-up, her sophomore album. Again, she's put in an extremely difficult position. How do you live up to everything that comes before? So she is being scrutinized very, very much at this point, because everything that she has released has been already compared to everything that came previous. Yeah, what are your thoughts on what we've seen so far?
Yes, yeah, I feel like, yeah, both of us have got a lot to say. I think obviously the lead single was in some sense similar to Driver's License in the way that it was more of a ballad, builds up and blows off on the final bridge chorus, very much like Driver's License. I think Vampire is incredible. I generally think that's her best song, personally, in my opinion.
Okay.
Lyricism incredible, love it. I just love the whole vibe of it. Really, really, really good. But it does sound very Olivia Rodrigo, what we know, just an enhancement of what we know. And obviously then aesthetically, with all the purple, is very much a continuation. I think lots of people were expecting an initial purple, but then we were going to be burst open with something else. And obviously then before we even really got the album, we then got the cover, which in my opinion, I think is lackluster. Like, I think, to be quite honest, it's a mediocre cover. Like, I think Sour is very simple, but in its simplicity, it's very iconic. But I think Guts is just simplistic. It's not giving anything. Like, at all. It is just a continuation of the original, and for me, I just think, doesn't make me think, oh, this is exciting. It doesn't,
I see,
give any like it doesn't make me interested or think or want to really check it out. I'm just like, okay, so this is going to be the same. And obviously then the next single, Bad Idea, right, just for me felt like a mishmash of brutal that I don't really like. A bad idea, right? It's not really my vibe. I feel like, and even the photo shoot just seems dull. And I know that photo shoots and album covers are not everything. Like, that is not, you know, at the end of the day, for me, I care more about the music and the quality of said music.
Of course.
But I think as a pop music fan and as a fan of music in general, there's something really appetizing about, like, a well-rounded era and a good old photo shoot and a good old album cover and just and something new and exciting. And you know, Taylor is the master of it. Other people that are also been masters of it is like Madonna, Miley Cyrus, for example, that, you know, reinvented themselves. And I think that then that is also a problem because then there's an expectation for reinvention.
It's a very difficult and position to be in. Very extremely difficult, because it's what we said about, you know, Billie Eilish kind of did reinvent herself. And even so, it was still compared and contrasted and suffered from that.
And was an overly,
and in this case, you know, it's more of like a continuation. How can these young pop stars win? Like, we can't ask too much of them. And I understand the tricky situation that they're in. Having said that, I do agree that I feel like I'm still in the Sour era. I feel like I'm still, you know, there. I don't know. Maybe when the whole album comes out, obviously we can't speak of that right now. Maybe there will be changes. Maybe, you know, the rest of the album will, you know, be incredible. We don't know. We don't know at this point. So that's why, you know, it's interesting to see what other people think. But it is sad, and it's a difficult position, because I understand, and like even Taylor herself said it, like, it's so horrible that you have to be put in a position that, you know, reinvent yourself. But be careful, not too much, not too little. And it is something that unfortunately female singers are asked more of than male singers in general. However, when we're talking about her, we're not comparing, we're not, you know, giving her a hard time because of that at all. I'd give the same hard time to any male singer, which
exactly.
I have many male singers.
That's one of the reasons why I much prefer female singers, because often
I agree.
Quality is there.
Yep.
And I'm always someone, as much as it, for me, it comes down to music, songwriting, and the feeling. No one can lie that it isn't fun having Easter eggs and things to look out for and stuff that references this that and a new sound to explore and open your own, not only open the artist's, you know, musical landscape, but also open your fans to more music and new sounds and new, you know, ideas of yourself. And I think that as a Taylor fan, we are often very spoiled.
Definitely.
But not only do we get the quality still, we also still get reinvention, and we kind of get it all really. And I think that sometimes there's an expectation that everyone has to be like that, when that's not always the case. So I think that Olivia Rodrigo is a really interesting one, because clearly she has decided not to do the reinvention and is very clearly building off of what she's established with Sour. And I think, going back to one of the previous people that we have kind of mentioned, it seems that most people try and change it up, like with the second.
Mm.
I think, you know, a prime example of that is Dua Lipa.
Right.
Future Nostalgia was a massive change up from her debut album. With Future Nostalgia, there was a really cohesive theme, and there was something, you know, very pop, old, you know, 2010s pop about it, of like just cohesive photo shoot and big singles and big pop, like a big pop era. And I think people really crave that. And I don't know, it's just, I'm really not too sure with Olivia Rodrigo and how this album's going to go down, because as of right now, even though it has been successful, the singles haven't been the level of success of Driver's License or Good For You, for example. Like, Vampire did debut at number one, hasn't been able to maintain that, and has been kind of flickering in and out of the top 10. And I think that I just don't really know how it's going to go down, because the reaction has been quite negative. I think that lots of people are being like, give us more. But then it's also bad to ask that from an artist, because why isn't it just about the music? Why does it have to be about all the marketing and commercial element? But then that's also what makes it kind of fun. I think that it's a real split decision. I'm sure that, let us know in the comments, because I'd be intrigued to hear other people's opinions, because I think that you're either one or the other. It's quite decisive. Some people say, you know, she needs to give us more. People are saying that has an element of sexism to it, because there is an expectation, a massive expectation on men to do the same. Why should someone have to? But then there's also a thing of, I don't want you to be boring.
Right.
You know? And I think that looking at the sophomore slump is really clear that no matter what you do,
you're damned if you do.
It doesn't always come down to that.
Yeah,
exactly. Sometimes it just comes down to external circumstances.
Yeah.
But what about you? Because I've rambled enough now. How are you feeling
about
it?
Yeah, I said most of what I wanted to anyway, and I do agree with you in most of what you said. Yeah, the only thing for me is I do feel like the era at this point, again, it could all be a bait and switch, and by the time this episode is out, we will know that. But obviously this is our past selves talking from the limited knowledge that we have. I don't know. I just don't feel very excited, which is a shame about this.
Yeah, same here.
The music coming. I don't feel like, I need to consume this music, because there's something that I really need to listen to, which is a shame. But also, I do understand that I am not the primary audience of...
Target audience.
Yeah, I'm not the primary target audience. I think that the primary audience perhaps is a little bit younger than myself. There's a lot of different things. Obviously, people have known Olivia from previous. I never knew of her, so it's different, right?
No, I didn't know of her.
I can still appreciate her music, and I do appreciate a lot of the songs on Sour.
Oh, because as a songwriter, like, Olivia is stellar. When you
especially
think of
for her
Sour
age, it's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Mm, her debut album. Like, think of where the hell she's going to be in album 5, 6, 7. Like, when
this
she's really, really, like, started to, like, hound her craft. Like, she's going to be incredible. She's a force to be reckoned with.
Whatever happens, I don't think it'll be the end for her in any way.
Oh, no.
But it is just an interesting point of her career in which, she's set up for... anything that she does is going to be compared to what comes before. And I'm sure if she went the other way like Billie did and went completely different, people would be like, oh, not sure if I like this. It's too different.
Yeah.
So it is very, very, very difficult. And I understand that. at the same time, it's very messy at the moment with some of her promo and some of the things that are being chucked around, which doesn't help the era at all. But, you know, these things happen. These things happen in the music industry. So
I think also what's interesting is that to be new and different, sometimes it totally just comes down to, like, colour. Like, literally, the colour being
aesthetic,
purple
sent
people wild. Like, no. Like, if that background was red, for example, or green,
that would have been, no one would have cared, I don't think. It's funny, though, isn't it?
Would there have been the same response? Like, if the photo shoots were identical, but the background was just a different colour. It's just really interesting how visually,
I don't know, because
it has an effect.
I agree with that, but then again, you listen to the music and you're like, okay, we're in the sour era.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know, but that is a very interesting thing. On the other hand, now that we've spoken about all of these albums that may or may not have suffered in certain ways, I think it's important also to note some of the ones that avoided the sophomore slump, and in fact, the other way around. The circumstances of their releases made these artists even bigger than they already were. So it's interesting to see, because I think everything does very much depend on how the debut is received and the comparison, because sometimes it can seem worse in comparison, but as we have seen, it's not that it is worse, it's just worse in comparison. So here are some examples of albums that obviously avoided the slump. I'm going to just read these out and then we can just chat about them. So we have Katy Perry, Teenage Dream, Adele, 21, Lady Gaga, Born This Way, Lord, Melodrama, Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, all iconic albums. There is no way to debate that. They're just albums that are so well known, produced many, many amazing singles, charted extremely highly, awards, everything. So it's interesting to see how it can be avoided, but it is interesting to talk about the debuts before these albums. But in a way, Katy, Adele, Lady Gaga, Lord, I think all of them though did have quite big debuts, to be honest with you.
I think they did have big and successful debuts, but not in the
same way
that I think Billy
and Olivia
Olivia have, where it was just like, Katy had, like, you know, Hot and Cold, I Kissed a Girl. Adele on her debut album had Chasing Pavements, Make You Feel My Love, you know, like, she's had still had big hits. Lord obviously had Royals, which was massive, Team, massive. Amy Winehouse, maybe not so. Her original album was slightly more like jazz and R&B, but was still met with good success and critical acclaim. Obviously, Lady Gaga, massive first album with The Fame. But I think what is slightly different is, though, that they were still building off of that success. They hadn't ticked every single box. Whereas I feel like with Olivia and Billy, it's almost like they'd done stuff within 2 years of their career that people are still dreaming about 6-7 years into their career, you know?
I see what you mean.
So I think that, like, with Lord, for example, like, Melodrama built off of it. Adele, 21, definitely built off. Katy Perry did. Lady Gaga. I think all of them built off. And I think that sometimes with the sophomore slump, all of the albums that we've talked about with the sophomore slump so far have all been albums that have had a crazy debut, like a massive, massive debut album.
Yeah.
Whereas I think often people that have a generally successful debut album maybe don't have the same problems with the sophomore slump. Like, I think maybe Ed Sheeran, for example, his sophomore album Multiplied, that was incredibly successful, and so was Plus was massive. He was everywhere, but I think that it still built off of it. Like, you know, he hadn't won every Grammy award under the sun at that point.
No,
every single being a number one, you know. I think it's a really hard one, because I feel like you can argue one point, but then another album proves the opposite.
I know, it's a difficult position to be in, and I think that leads us to talk about Fearless, really, because it's the one that is very interesting to see, and obviously we are Taylor fans, so it's the one that we know most about, right? Of course it avoided the sophomore slump, but that is because there is kind of a difference in situation. Debut had done extremely well. As Billboard describes, the album debut is a sleeper hit. It initially debuted on the Billboard 200 at number 19, but it eventually grew into the longest charting 2000s album on the chart. Even to this day, like, its longevity is incredible, but it was different.
Oh,
it wasn't,
on another level.
She wasn't everywhere. She didn't win everything, but then she kind of did.
No, she was
Fearless.
Very much in the... Exactly. She'd very much established herself in the country world.
Exactly.
And I think what Fearless did was then establish herself in the pop world.
Yeah. She explored her pop sensibilities, her carefully crafted lyricism. She took into account the shortcomings of the debut album in order to polish her second project, which was very interesting because she did spend many years, like you said previously, many years crafting the debut album and only had a limited amount of time to produce Fearless. So it's very interesting. Fearless, obviously, we know that it debuted at number one on the Billboard 200. It sold so many copies. The album spent 11 non-consecutive weeks at number one. It has hits like Love Story and You Belong With Me. I really do think that Fearless, it just became like, in a way, for many international fans, I think as well, the debut album of Taylor, in a way.
Oh, 100%. And it was marketed that way internationally. Even when you just look at the Fearless International version, it includes songs off of the debut album, because the debut album wasn't really sold or marketed or pushed to the international audience, because country music at that time wasn't very international. So they made sure they established herself in the country world, build a foundation and a rooting there. And then because Fearless did explore that more pop element, and Taylor naturally had quite a pop, you know, sound to her, even though she was still very much country, it was then easy to market her as that and then build off of it, but also establish her for the first time to lots of audiences, you know, like to introduce her, sorry, to audiences for the first time, because that was the first album I was ever exposed to. And
me too.
For Love Story is the first song I ever heard, and I think for lots of people, probably at the time, felt like it was her debut song. I definitely did. That was all I knew at the time.
I think
that that's kind of what they did.
Yeah. And then, of course, we know that Fearless went on to win Grammy Album of the Year. It was one of the most awarded country album. So it's interesting then to look at how Speak Now, in comparison, you know, was that in a way her slump era? I know that's very strange to say, but we can't really speak of a sophomore slump at all with Fearless, because she was still growing. But then after peaking, is the whole sophomore slump thing really just, it's very difficult to follow from a peak in your career? Is that
any
just,
success?
Is that just it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's like, maybe it's just because any album can be difficult. Yeah, exactly. Any album can be hard to follow on from. It's like Taylor, like how on earth does she follow on from the success of Midnights? And, you know, how on earth did she follow on from the success of 1989 and then Reputation?
Yeah.
And, but then, you know, Folklore and Evermore.
Could we perhaps consider Reputation being a little bit snubbed and a little bit misunderstood as also kind of a slump era? Again, this is no shade whatsoever to either of those albums. They're some of my favourite albums, and
you
know, we're Taylor fans, but it's just
massive Taylor fans through and through.
Again, and looking from the outside in terms of charts and Grammys and etc., right? So yeah, it's interesting to see in these ones that avoided, that we've spoken about, included Fearless, the next album after that, for example, Lord, Melodrama, and what follows, Solar Power.
Exactly.
Melodrama is such an peak. It's such an amazing album, so solid, so beloved, to be followed by and Solar even Power.
Exactly, and even Lord herself described Solar Power as
a lull.
A trough between two peaks.
Oh, I hate and she was that. Hoping that, you know, that's next. So sad.
And I think it's really sad because I love Solar Power. I don't really get the criticism towards it. I think that it just wasn't what people expected.
That's it.
People expected a continuation of Melodrama.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't. And nothing was overly radio friendly. It was a bit more conceptual, a bit slower, you know, a bit more of a grower
in that sense rather than
big pop.
You need time with it.
So I think that. Exactly. And I think it's the case with lots of other artists as well, even verging into the country world. Maren Morris, for example, had a massive debut album with Hero and My Church. And then Girl, her second album, The Bones, was one of her most successful hits ever and was really, really successful. And Humble Quest, I think, was maybe a slight lull in comparison. You know, it had a really big lead single, Circles Around This Town, but the ones subsequently haven't really landed as much. And now she's working with Jack on her fourth album, which will be really interesting. So she's working with Jack Antonoff for the first time. So I think it is just naturally, I think what we've discovered through this is that you're doomed if you do and you're doomed if you don't.
Right.
It is a bit of a poison chalice being so successful too quickly, but that technically the sophomore slump is actually just, you've been really successful and how do you follow on from that, whether you're album one or album 10.
Right.
You know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah. And obviously I think it's more common for sophomores to slump just because you are so new to the music industry. And like you said before with Billy, what do I get from this? It seems like everyone liked this. So what do I do? Just copy and paste? Or do I move on from it? Or if I move on, will it be too quick? Whereas if you, you know, follow up further along into your career, like 1989, you already have a lot of knowledge of how the music industry sees you and works. And you can, obviously, it's a very different position Taylor was in for Reputation, because it wasn't just the, I mean, it was everything of the end of the 1989 era. If we get into that, we could talk for a whole other hour. But it's also a case of how far along are you into your career and how well can you respond to what looks like a peak and what may be coming after that peak. How can you, you know, do something that follows up to that without being compared to the previous thing and seen as, again, quote unquote, worse. But like we said, it's all very, very subjective. Some people probably maybe won't like debut albums and then love the second one that is considered a sophomore slump. There is always something out there for everyone. This is just interesting to see with the facts and the figures and, you know, how people have perceived these albums. But that does not mean, again, that they are bad albums. Everyone likes something different. And if one of these albums we spoke about is your favorite album, then go ahead and defend it in the comments. Let us know why you think that it didn't, you know, it didn't suffer from this slump at all.
And also, yeah, let us know some other albums as well, because there's so many we could have got into. For example, Ariana Grande's My Everything, that was an incredibly successful album, big singles, big hits. Let us know some other albums that you think did or didn't. We'd love to kind of hear some more thoughts and more kind of perspective, because we could sit here all day. I'm sure this episode is long enough already. It's fun to kind of explore, and I think that it's a really interesting theory to kind of analyze different careers, perspectives, and just the general music industry. We've now come to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. As we've said throughout the episode, let us know your thoughts in the comment section over on YouTube. And also, just to double mention as well, that obviously the stuff that we have said regarding our opinions on albums is an opinion. Therefore, it does not take away from your opinion or love or dislike of the album. It's an opinion. Take it as so. Thanks again for listening. If you did enjoy, obviously follow us over on Instagram, which is at Swiftly Spoken Podcast, just so you can stay up to date with when we're releasing new episodes. Also give this episode a like on YouTube, subscribe to us over on YouTube, and please leave us a review over on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But thank you so much again for listening, and hopefully we'll see you soon.